The Pat Kenny Show.
With the Jaguar E-Pace. Beautiful by design and dynamic to drive. Delivering performance that is unmistakably Jaguar.
This is News Talk.
Obstetrician and former master of the National Maternity Hospital, Peter Boylan, was at the birth of more than 6,000 babies. He introduced the epidural on request to any woman who wanted it, and he's been at the coalface of all recent tough debates between church, state and the world of medicine. And he's written all about it in a new book, and he is with us in studio this morning. Peter, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Pat.
Speaking of babies, you yourself a very sick baby, by all accounts.
I was, yes. When I was 6 weeks old, I had a condition known as pyloric stenosis, which
what is
a blockage.
That?
It's a blockage at the exit of the stomach, going down into the rest of the bowel. So the result of that is that one vomits, projectile vomiting. So I could hit the wall at 6 feet.
Okay.
The GP that my mother brought me to said it was constipation. She didn't believe it. She had been trained as a nurse. So she phoned Coleman Saunders, who was a paediatrician at the time. And he said, oh, that's pyloric stenosis. Bring him in. And John Shanley, who was the only paediatric surgeon in the country at the time, operated on me, and Coleman Saunders and John Shanley saved my life.
So my goodness, was, yeah. as just as a young baby?
At 6 weeks, yeah.
Now, you actually came across Mr. Saunders later on.
I did, yes. I won a medal in paediatrics called the Coleman Saunders Medal, and it was lovely because Coleman Saunders himself presented it to me.
Yeah.
So when he did that, I was able to tell him about the story about my mother phoning him. So it was a lovely kind of reunion, I suppose.
A symmetry there. In
a symmetry, in absolutely, that. Yes.
And now, yeah. Your own background, you mentioned your mother trained as a nurse. On yeah. Your father's side, there was a great maritime history.
There was, yes, and it can be traced right back to the middle of the 1700s, in fact. And his grandfather died on his own ship coming back from Bordeaux. He had been down to Constantinople bringing linen and so on down to Constantinople. Then sailing back, they would stop off and bring, with spices from Constantinople, they would stop off in Portugal for port, and in Bordeaux then for fine wines with the big houses around County Louth and County Meath. But getting back on the boat in Bordeaux, he slipped, banged his head, and by the time he got back to Drogheda, he was dead.
My
so
goodness.
My great-grandfather died
at sea.
At sea, yeah.
At
yeah,
sea.
At sea.
And then that did not deter his son from going to sea.
No, his son, my grandfather, then went to sea, and he ended up captaining a ship, T. Clipper, which went around Cape Horn up to San Francisco and back. Carrying cargo, and I have a picture of him on the boat in San Francisco with the crew around him. So that was a fantastic tradition. And then his son,
your father,
my father, then was a keen sailor, but because of the depression at the time when he was growing up, there was no opportunity to go to sea. But his uncle, or his brother, my uncle Willie, went to sea and was a merchant seaman in the war and got an OBE for services during the war.
Services during the war, when it was dangerous to be a merchant seaman.
Yeah, he was shot, or not shot, but his ship was sunk by submarines off the coast of Tory Island.
Now, your own story, you begin in 1973 when you were a student doctor and the Inuptas ward in Holles Street. What was that?
The Inuptas, that's the Latin word for unmarried. So there was a large ward, and in that were all of the unmarried girls who and women, young women, who were coming in from, I presume, the Magdalen laundries. And I have a memory of them coming in from places like Dunboyne, Eglinton Road and so on. And they were segregated. Now, to us working in the hospital and to everybody else in Irish society, nobody passed any comment on that. And we didn't. It was just the way it was. But looking back on it now, it was an extraordinary... It may have been felt to be very sensitive because they may have been embarrassed among other people.
For privacy purposes, or it may have been that they really were pariahs in someone's eyes.
Yeah, it was the society that we lived in at that time, which was in the 70s and early 70s.
Was the influence of Board of Governors of the National Maternity Hospital evident at that time, because the Archbishop of Dublin was nominally the boss?
The Archbishop is the chairman of the board, but that dates back to the Royal Charter. when whoever happened to be the Catholic Archbishop at the time was automatically chairman of the board of the National Maternity Hospital.
But what, were you conscious of that influence at the time, back in the 70s?
No, but I mean the whole of Irish society was influenced by the church. We were effectively a theocracy at that stage.
Now, having qualified, you went on your travels.
I did, yes. Well, I trained initially in Holles Street and then I went to London to Queen Charlotte's and the Chelsea Hospital for Women. And I was 18 months in that position, and then I did a research job again back in Queen Charlotte's and partly in the Hammersmith Hospital. So I was there for about 4 years and learnt an awful lot, and that's where I encountered termination of pregnancy for the first time and had a lot of discussions with my colleagues, other trainees.
Now, what was your attitude to termination at that time? I mean, were you kind of staunchly at one with the Catholic teaching on it at that stage?
I didn't really have any attitude because I hadn't encountered it.
Yeah.
So it never really entered my thoughts. And it never really crossed us in Ireland in Holles Street, because younger women going to, or women going to the UK for a termination, would never turn up in an Irish maternity hospital. They just go straight away. And diagnosis of fetal abnormality was very unusual antenatally, because ultrasound wasn't developed well. And ultrasound was really only introduced in Ireland in obstetric practice in the 70s, early mid-70s. So it was very, we just didn't have those diagnoses, and abortion really never entered our thoughts.
So babies with that fetal abnormality, it just came as a terrible shock to the mother and father at birth.
Almost always. Occasionally an X-ray would be done, which would diagnose anencephaly, a very severe form of where the brain doesn't develop. But that would usually be quite late in pregnancy. The women didn't ask for termination and the doctors didn't terminate the pregnancy.
Now, the 1983 referendum on the 8th, you say it just passed you by.
It did. I mean, at that time as an assistant master, like,
given
Holland,
your recent history, quite remarkable.
It's just quite ironic looking back on it. But in point of fact, I was kind of conscious of it going on out there, if you like. But out there, effectively, was outside Holles Street, because we worked mad hours. For example, a weekend on duty started on a Friday morning, and we would get home then on a Monday afternoon, having done our Monday morning work. So we were in the hospital Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and a bit of Monday, then home, sleep, back into the hospital on Tuesday, maybe on duty again on the Wednesday. So any kind of debates outside what was actually happening at work, and then obviously social life outside. But I knew the debate was going on, but it kind of was really of no relevance to us on a personal level, because we were so just working, really.
Now, you mentioned the maritime tradition in your family, and you still sail.
I do, yes.
But the other sport you're passionate about is rugby.
Yeah, I played.
You played well, actually.
Well, I had a lot of. I was in Mary's in Rathmines, which is a big rugby school. And at the time, when I was in school, we had a fantastic team. So I was lucky enough to get on this senior cup team when I was 15 in fourth year. And I was a wing forward. The other wing forward was Shay Deering, who went on to captain Ireland and got some caps and so on. He died, unfortunately, quite early at the age of 42. But and then the next year we were beaten in the final. And then I also played for Leinster Schools and under-19s and under-21s. And then, that was the time when Shay Deering was around, Fergus Slattery was around, Stuart McKinney. And then later on you had John O'Driscoll. When I played in London Irish, I played with him. So, yeah, I mean, I played at a reasonable level, and we made great friends, still friends, closest friends are rugby.
Would you
friends.
Credit rugby with passing on particular life characteristics to you?
Yeah, and one of the features about most sports, but rugby in particular, because that's my experience and a bit of sailing as well, is that on the pitch you can knock lumps out of each other. It's not personal. It's all about the competition. But when the final whistle goes and it's over, you shake hands and then you're back to your normal relationship. And that's a really important life lesson, that when you're involved in some kind of fight or argument, that don't take it personally. Get stuck in, make your point strongly, and try and win. But when it's over, if you win or you lose, you shake hands and you say, okay, it's over now, we're back to our normal relationship. Now, that obviously has resonance in the current hospital row. That game is not over yet.
Yeah, and can you have cordial relations with people that you're metaphorically tearing lumps out of?
Up to a point, but the whistle hasn't gone. The final whistle hasn't gone. The people who are going to blow the whistle are the Vatican.
All right, and we'll talk about that in a moment. America beckoned to you then.
Yes, I finished my training in Hollow Street, and there were no jobs because we were in the midst of, we were the poor man of Europe at the time, and it was one of those economic depressions. And I'd always felt that I would like to work in the States just to see what it was like. I had an ambition to become Master of Hollow Street, and I figured that international experience would stand to me. We had a research project run by Dermot MacDonald, one of the masters, and that was recognised around the world as being hugely influential. I was part of that study as one of the people working on it. And I went and presented the results at a meeting in the United States and then travelled around to a few places and got job offers in Canada, California, mm-hmm. and Texas. So I went to Texas because there was a new chairman going there from San Francisco who was a world-renowned researcher on premature birth. And apart from wanting to work with him, I wanted to see how he managed to make change, effect change in a department. Because in the United States, there's a lot of fluidity and there's a lot of dynamism in the way departments are run. So a chairman can have a big influence. So I just wanted to see how did he manage all that. So I went to Texas and stayed there for 4 years and on the faculty. And it was a hugely valuable experience on all sorts of levels.
Now, you achieved your life ambition. You became master of Hollow Street Hospital. It's a kind of, it reflects your experience and your professional excellence and so on, but it's not a permanent job. It does not last.
Yeah, and that's one of the great things about it, actually. for the master, whoever it happens to be at the time, because of the very tough job. So you devote yourself to it for 7 years. You're looking after women exclusively for 7 years. But then if the master is not great, well, it's over in 7 years.
Yeah.
And also you've got a defined period of time in which to make change, to effect change. So it gives you an opportunity to say, okay, during my period of time, this is what I want to achieve. And you set out to do it, and you hope that you will be able to. But you know you've got 7 years to do it.
One of the extraordinary things, you know, when I read you introduced epidural on demand, you know, an epidural for every member of the audience, if you want one.
So to speak.
And that is just so taken for granted now.
It is, yes. I mean, at the time, epidurals were around for a good while. I'd seen in London and seen it in the United States, obviously. But there was a conservatism in Hollow Street because of a concern about the effect of epidurals on labour and concerns that it might increase the number of forceps deliveries, make the birthing process less satisfying for women. That was one of the attitudes. And also because of the economic situation, we had a shortage of anaesthetists. So there was a dual sort of issues at work there. Now, my predecessor, John Strong, was able to appoint more consultants towards the end of his time. And then I took over and I was able to say, look, we have the ability now to give epidurals to anybody who wants one. They're merely a superb form of pain relief, nothing more, nothing less. And to the credit of the midwives in the labour ward, we didn't have an increase in forceps or caesarean sections, and women were much happier. Pain is not an ennobling experience. Childbirth is different. Some women like to go through childbirth without any form of pain relief, and that's fine. But they should have the choice if you want an epidural.
And you
the
gave
best
it
form
to
of
them.
Pain relief.
So much happened around the 8th, and we don't need to rehearse it because we did it on this program so many times.
Yeah,
and we talked about Savita, the late Savita, which possibly in terms of changing public opinion was the key moment.
It was a seminal moment, and I go through it in the book in a lot of detail. And the other thing that I do in the book is to explain the background situation for the nurses working on the ward where Savita was, which was really quite hard to understand how people were asked to work in such dreadful conditions. There were two nurses looking after too many women on the ward where Savita was. One of them was pregnant. They were working 12 hours from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. They had been complaining before Savita ever went into hospital about the workload and concerns about safety of patients. And during the time that Savita was there, one woman died. They had other women who were getting out of bed. They had people who were alcoholics. They had women who were extremely sick post-operatively. They looked after all the emergencies. They didn't get any sufficient help during the nights they were on call, on duty. And in fact, on the third night, in the Tuesday into the Wednesday morning when Savita got severely ill, the two nurses coming on duty broke down and cried because here they were facing another night with no help And that was very distressing for them. And then, of course, when Savita died, it was just devastating. Yeah.
As I say, a key moment in the whole debate about repealing the Eighth. And, of course, that was a successful campaign. You were the inverse of the poster boy. You were the anti-hero. You were the villain. And you attracted much odium. But at the end of the day, your stance was vindicated. But, of course, you couldn't leave controversy alone. You got involved with the movement of the National Maternity Hospital at St. Vincent's, and you pointed out that the influence of the Catholic Church might persist under the way the whole deal was being structured, and it's still the same.
And it's still the same. The issue, the fundamental issue, is the ownership of the land on which the hospital is going to be built. And if that land is what's known as ecclesiastical land, which is owned by any branch of the Catholic Church, then any building on it has to adhere to Catholic ethos. And
is that canon law?
That is canon law, yes, which operates in St. Vincent's at the moment. So if people want to say, well, surely state law and canon law can't be in conflict.
Because we're always talking about how dare these people insist on Sharia law in a country where we have the law of the land.
Yeah.
And you're saying that there is actually some version of that almost.
Well, Catholic ethos operates, for example, in the Mater Hospital, St. Vincent's Hospital, and in the Bon Secours group. And what that means is anybody in that group cannot, for example, have a sterilization operation if the purpose of it is to prevent childbearing, which there's very little other purpose. Abortion clearly is absolutely banned under the Sisters of Charity Ethical Code, banned under the Irish Bishops Ethical Code. And that's all fine. We all know that. But what people fail, I think, to understand is the importance of the ownership of the piece of land that the hospital is built on. So at the moment, the Sisters of Charity have applied to the Vatican for permission to what's known as alienate the land. Now, they only came out in public and said that when inquiries were put in on foot of the imminent publication of this book. Before that, we were being told everything is fine, there's no problems, there are no outstanding issues and so on. Well, there are. The major outstanding issue is that permission is required from the Vatican to alienate the land, that is, put the land and all of the property into a civil structure that is going to allow the building of a maternity hospital in which sterilization, IVF, abortion and so on, which are all banned under Catholic teaching. So the Vatican now have a decision to make. Are they going to allow the Sisters of Charity transfer the land into an entity which will allow the building of a hospital where these procedures will take place? So, as I say, the whistle hasn't gone yet.
Okay.
And it's the Vatican who can blow the whistle.
Are we in terms of the construction of the new maternity hospital? Because the cranes are down there.
Yeah. Well, the Minister for Health has said quite correctly that nothing further is going to happen until all outstanding issues are resolved. And the most outstanding issue, obviously, is the permission of the Vatican. Last December, there was a public push because of what's known as NZEB regulations, building regulations to do with the environment. And it was put about that there were no outstanding issues, that the sisters didn't have to ask permission. They could seek advice but not ask for permission. So that was put about, and the government were effectively backed into saying, yeah, you can go ahead with the first phase, which is 43 million. So if this whole thing fails, then there will be 43 million of state money gone.
And do we have any indication as to how the Vatican is feeling about this? Because, you know, they might fear Vatican gives go-ahead to abortion-type headlines.
Well, that effectively is what the headlines would be. Now, there isn't a single hospital in the entire world built on land owned by the Catholic Church that allows these procedures, and there's plenty of examples. And the consequences for the Sisters of Charity, if they build the hospital and then terminations are performed, is that they could be excommunicated. There was a Sister McBride in Phoenix who allowed a termination in the hospital that they were owned because a woman was going to die if she didn't have a termination of pregnancy, and she was excommunicated. It's not a sort of a straightforward thing, oh, we'll just switch it over into a civil structure. We've got to see what that structure is.
Well, Peter, the book is fabulous. Its title is In the Shadow of the Eighth, subtitle My 40 Years Working for Women's Health in Ireland. It's published by Penguin Ireland. It's around €15, I think, in all good bookshops.
Yeah, roughly about that.
Roughly at that. And its author, Dr. Peter Boylan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Pat.